we've heard a lot of things about the way we now are investigating string theory, about someone told me that perhaps we should have this discussion without ever mentioning the word landscape, but we will. The landscape of string theory, we're having some evidence for it, and obviously we're going to discuss a bit more of it. We have some panelists here that are going to hopefully get a lot of questions, and I will pose some of those questions. But let's briefly sort of take a step back, and why are we having this sort of reflective discussion about string theory? Again, string theory sort of started in 1968, but it has these revolutions. It had them in 84 or in 95, the deep brain revolution. And each of these revolutions, in some sense, were sort of new starts to the theory, sufficiently drastic that you could say, well, that's when the theory sort of began. So depending on your perspective on this, string theory is either 10 years old, or 21 years old, or close to 40 years old, which means that string theory, if we take the human scale, is either just entering puberty, or it's just reaches legal drinking age, or enters his midlife crisis. And depending on that, point of view, you can say, well, either we're now in a period of rebellion, or a period of irresponsibility, or both. but any case, it's good to have a topic to discuss where people care about and where people can differ of opinions. Again, I'm moderating this discussion, so I'll try to not stir it up when it's not necessary. But nonetheless, rather than being a moderator, I'll sometimes try to be the devil's advocate, which I think is a more constructive way, perhaps, of contributing to this. I feel actually I'm a little bit in the minority in terms of maybe if I want to be the devil's advocate, but Shamit, when I invited him to be on the panel, was afraid that he might be the one that's going to be attacked over the landscape, which has happened before, where obviously it stirs some emotion, but we'll see how it goes. So maybe I want to start sort of at a friendly level in the terminology of the friendly landscape. But the question is, okay, have we now really convinced ourselves that there is a landscape? Is there still a very important work to do before we have reached that conclusion? And or can we now sort of say that there is basically, obviously from the talks of today, one would say that there is a consensus that there is a landscape. But the question is there really such a consensus? And I think that's maybe where we want to get started, and then go from there further on. Again, people indeed from the audience can at any moment indeed ask to throw something in. Okay, so let me indeed narrow the question down. If we talk about is there a landscape, for now I'll ask it sort of in purely in string theory. Does string theory have a landscape of vacua that are under control as a theoretical non-supersymmetric ones? Okay. So maybe I'll give the microphone. There are two microphones here, so take any of them if you want to say something to people that have worked on the string landscape, and then we'll go from there.
Is it working now? Okay. Well, there's really an easy way to decide this question, which we should start with, and then I'll say what I actually think. So you're a bunch of string theorists. If you believe that there's some significant evidence that there's a string theory landscape, raise your hand. Okay, and if you believe that there is not such evidence, as opposed to having no opinion, raise your hand. Good. So it's pretty clear that there's not a strong consensus. That there is a sizable fraction of people who believe there's a lot of evidence, that there's a small fraction of people who think, after careful consideration, that there is no evidence, and that there are a lot of people who haven't considered the evidence. Well, I asked the question in the most general way. I'll trust people to interpret it correctly. My own opinion is that while the fact is certainly not established at the level that we established the existence of supersymmetric landscapes of precisely defined quantum gravity theories, for instance, ADS quantum gravity, or theories in Minkowski space above five or six dimensions, where matrix theory gives an exact non-perturbative definition. If one is willing to accept the idea that effective field theory applies in string theory in its regime of self-consistent applicability, that is, you make an ansatz, you check whether you have a solution in that ansatz, and then you look at the next order correction, try to make sure it's small, then the questions that we face in establishing the answer, is there a landscape or not, are very answerable questions. We've seen a lot of progress in making these questions more and more precise between 1985 and today. And, you know, my opinion based on work that exists now is that a focused effort for a few years could pretty definitively answer that question. And my suspicion is, because I do trust effective field theory and I see all the ingredients there in string theory, that the answer is going to be yes. And then the deeper question will be, is effective field theory enough? Is there some mysterious reason that de Sitter space escapes considerations of effective field theory? And on that, I have no answer because I haven't learned too much in string theory about how to get insight when effective field theory doesn't apply. Yeah, so I mean, there are many things you could mean. One is, everything that I've talked about today, or most of the speakers talked about, started in critical string theory in 10 or 11, well, M theory in 11 dimensions. You could mean, what do we think about vacua that compactify from 10 to 8 or 7 or 6 instead of 4? Or you could mean, should we consider other dimensions too, like non-critical strings, supercritical strings? And I think, by all means, one could consider compactification to other dimensions, and at least for dimensions less than 4, it looks like the same things that lead to large sets of solutions in 4 dimensions would lead to large sets of solutions in 3 and 2 dimensions. Above 4, it's a little dicier. The kinds of corrections that exist in supersymmetric theories are more constrained, and one might not actually find similar results. And I don't have any opinion yet about theories that break supersymmetry at a very high scale because I haven't studied them.
Apparently he couldn't make it, but he sent me an email, and he brought up actually this problem of three-dimensional compactifications that sort of lead to a puzzle, clearly, because if you take the compactifications to three dimensions from M theory, first of all, there are many more of them than to four dimensions. So if one would use counting or other kinds of arguments, you would predict that we live in three dimensions rather than in four, which is not what we want to conclude. And second of all, if you want to have minima, which seemingly are possible to make, at least from the KKT type constructions, where the ADS curvature radius is much larger, or the cosmological constant there is much, much smaller than the compactification radius. In terms of the dual theory, this would mean that there's a huge class of conformal field theories that would correspond to those kind of compactifications. And two-dimensional conformal field theories have been studied to death almost, but we have not found such a huge class of superconformal field theory. So how can one reconcile it?
I'll make two comments. Let me comment on the second very concrete point first, and then on the first one second. It's actually a very interesting challenge to find CFT duals to gravity theories with this gap. Let me point out that, in fact, your comment that we haven't discovered any such CFTs is a bit too strong. We've discovered CFTs that do have such a huge gap, but that have one other scale in them also, or in some cases, two other scales. For instance, the compactifications ADS3 cross S3 cross T4 or K3. The T4 and K3 radii generally are very small compared to the ADS cross S. There's one set of spacings of conformal dimensions associated with the ADS radius 1 over R, and there's a vast gap to the KK scale, and then there's another tower. So in fact, by already existing examples of ADS CFT duality, we do see such large gaps. The new thing here is simply to get rid of the S3. And you know, the technical reasons we think that that's possible is that Freund-Rubin is very limited in what it can do relative to theories with more ingredients, but it would, of course, be very nice to explicitly exhibit families of CFTs with these properties. And sorry, I'm speaking a lot. In response to your first point, I would only say that very few people that I know of have advocated counting all possible solutions to string theory with some weight and then averaging to decide what's most probable. I actually don't know anyone who's advocated that seriously. But I have colleagues who would be happy to say that there are anthropic reasons one couldn't live in three dimensions, and so from the start, this is an exceptionally uninteresting thing to ask.
The technical details of the discussion, because the original conjecture in string theory, which is actually an old conjecture that goes is much older than string theory, is that when we unified all the interactions, we would have a unique unification. It would lead to predictions for the values of the parameters of the standard model. And all that I need to think that the discussion is interesting is to notice that that hasn't happened. I mean, I personally am less convinced than you are about the validity of effective field theory because I worry more than you do about whether or not there's anything that effective field theory is approximating. But even leaving that aside, clearly the direction, the thing that string theory has failed to do and was failing to do already from the advent of the Calabi-Yau compactifications was show any evidence that it would lead to a unique phenomenology. And the present situation is just made what was already a very severe problem much more severe. And for that reason, exploring these ideas, I think, is worth exploring.
Right. Yeah, the point that you're bringing up is sort of what people that want to bring up sort of the next one. It's clear that once, that's why I was first wanted to know, okay, do we believe that the landscape is there? And if we, once we sort of reach that conclusion, and we should do it sort of maybe cautiously, then the next question is, okay, well, what does it imply for what string theory really is going to do for us? Should we view it indeed as a positive or as a negative? Obviously, we have heard arguments what we should be doing with it, but I think it's still last word about that certainly has not been said. So maybe as a sort of a next step in this particular discussion. So one way of using the landscape was indeed discussed by Nima, and I want to erase this and get some more space, but there's no way of doing that. Okay, oh well. Here we go. So there was a discussion indeed about parameters that are going to be scanned and parameters that are sort of maybe have a more peaked distribution. And the hope is indeed that the cosmological constant and the mu parameter are the things that are going to be scanned. So basically you have a distribution that's sort of pretty even. And other ones would be sort of peaked. And this would be the sort of the optimal scenario that would come out in terms of the number of vacua in as a function of these couplings. So is there any evidence, first of all, in string theory that this is going to be what comes out?
One comment about it, isn't that they have different widths? At least what I was saying, isn't that they're different widths?
I was saying that absolutely everything has a narrow distribution. That was the conjecture. It's just that if the distributions for the relevant parameters are narrow and centered around something such that the tails don't go through zero, there will simply be no low energy world there.
So even if it would be like that, that would be fine as far as you're
concerned. Right. So the point is that if everything is narrow, there is a prediction that the only parameters that will scan once you get to have a low energy world to begin with are the relevant parameters. That's all. So it's
okay.
Just
a technical. But then I sort of have a sort of a follow-up question to that, because isn't the status that we are at, because partly this whole scanning idea, or at least this is sort of somewhat broad, gives the confidence that we can actually have a landscape, because obviously we need to enormously tune that. And indeed, if we want to have a very small value of this thing, and this happens to be a Gaussian centered around non-zero, then we do have an enormously small chance of actually reaching here. So we're a little bit sort of like saying, well, we need from low energy, or say, observations, the way he was saying it, well, the relevant operators need to be scanned. That was sort of an implication. this goes this way, right? The implication. But the other implication of, namely, the fact that we have a landscape is that the relevant operators are scanned. We have to assume that, otherwise we cannot have a landscape. And the fact that the landscape contains the standard model is maybe what gives us some evidence that we can appear. But this is, it's a quiver diagram, but it's not, it's circular. So where do we get started in this circle of arguments?
I'm not sure. I don't think I understand the question.
No, so in order to get, even to make a discussion, it's, there are some, so what I mean by the landscape, the fact is there a standard model,
sure,
including cosmology,
right,
that is contained in the landscape? You can argue that that's the case on the basis of having broad distributions. Otherwise, you would not be able to argue that that's the case.
I don't think you have to have broad distributions. You can have narrow distributions whose centers are not order one away, but are of order, in my examples, instead of being of order one away, they're of order one over root n away. All you need is for the relevant parameters, you just need to be able to scan around zero. And I'm just saying that's consistent with narrow distributions. For instance, in now, by the way, it's far from obvious that the distributions will actually be narrow. Maybe all distributions are broad for everything. That's certainly possible.
But is there any evidence one or the other way right now? Shamit brought it up. At least maybe Bobby should mention a little bit about his results, which sort of seemed to indicate that there were certain cases where things were pretty narrow distributions. And is that something that will maintain?
So in these G2 ensembles of vacua, and I guess also now these type 2A ones that Oliver and Shamit were talking about, you do get these kind of peak distributions for, say, the cosmological constant. And so that may be good enough, you know, for you to, you know, scan around the tail of one of these things. But, I mean, some preliminary work that I've been doing with my student, Roberto Valandro, on how the Yukawa coupling scan is not pushing us in any friendly direction. The Yukawa seem to have a much flatter distribution than.
So is that good news or bad news?
But that's bad news for the friendly idea. But.
Looks like the standard model,
right? Yeah. No, initially for the cosmological constant, I would say yes. But on the other hand, it's also true that we would like to know sort of, okay, well, what does it look like in our neighborhood?
Sure. I just want to give a sort of simple physical picture for what something like this, what would give rise to fairly narrow distributions. It could be that all of the scanning for supersymmetry breaking scales, for example, are happening in some hidden sector. Maybe they're in the head of some compactification, and the standard model live on some brains down the throat. Well, it's not crazy that as you bounce around and turn around all the fluxes, all the stuff just goes into changing all the supersymmetry breaking parameters, while all the Yukawa couplings and everything have to do with local properties of the distances between intersections and other things on the brains that live down the throat. It may even be that there is a mini landscape for the Yukawa couplings, because there could be different numbers of combinatorial ways of interspersing different Yukawa couplings. So you might have, you know, small numbers involving 10 chooses for the number of ways you can distribute those guys, while you have the 10 to the 120 in the other part. It seems to me difficult at the moment to since it's so easy to imagine, I mean, it doesn't sound like some gymnastics to make such a thing happen. It certainly seems like a possibility. I have no idea if it's realized. And of course, there's the entire cosmological piece on top of it all, which goes beyond anything that you get from counting. The only point I was trying to make earlier is that there is a hypothesis that all distributions are narrow, which leads to a sort of prediction that the things that this sort of environmental reasoning has been successfully used for so far can be justified. Maybe they can be justified in some other way. Maybe they're wrong. Maybe the whole thing's wrong.
Okay. Fair thing.
What do you mean, sum over everything?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Ah, but sorry. Let me say what my wild hope is. Okay, let me say what my wild hope is that you guys can answer. I can't. But the wild hope, and the thing that I find exciting about this whole business, is whether you like or hate the idea that this is how the CC problem is solved. If this is how the CC problem is solved, this is the first time I've ever seen that the solution of the cosmological constant problem can act as a big selector on what the low-energy world can look like. So the sort of thing that might happen, maybe in all the places where the distributions are narrow, you count and you count and you count, and there's 10 of the 80 around any location where it looks like the standard model. I don't know why, okay, but maybe it turns out to be that way. Well, throw them all out. You can't possibly make structure there. So it could be that as an incidental consequence of the place where you manage to make a structure correlated with that, you find narrow distributions. I don't know. But that's at least a sort of global hope, is that it's really simple counting and no probabilistic arguments, but just counting can vastly restrict the space in which particle physics can come out. That's a deliriously exciting idea. Okay, that you look around and nope, can't. Technicolor, 10 to the 50 vacua, cannot do it. Low energy supersymmetry, 10 to the 60 vacua, cannot do it. But maybe over there, 10 to the 200, some really weird thing, I can do it. Or maybe it'll turn out to be some other way. Maybe we will vastly prefer low energy SUSY, or maybe it'll be some of the other things that we've been talking about, like I was mentioning, that even if you vastly prefer a high-energy SUSY, you might still be forced into having a low-energy SUSY for other reasons. It seems to me that just the exploration of the qualitative ideas, even, is in its infancy, and the sorts of things that can come out are a little bit non-trivial. So, I mean, one of the criticisms about the whole business is that, you're giving up, and there's... it all just starts turning into words, and it's just terrible, and this is not the way physics is supposed to be, and so on. But I think there is part of it. Weinberg has a very nice phrase, but it's really wonderful that Weinberg did this, by the way, because you can keep saying Weinberg over and over again. yes, it says something very nice, that theoretical physicists have more often made errors not taking their theories seriously enough than taking them too seriously. Okay, so we can keep hoping for some magical, mystical breakdown of effective field theory and holography and new VIR connections and something we can't possibly imagine yet to solve the CC problem. And maybe it's right, and I would be incredibly happy if something like that was right, and we should still keep thinking about it, and no one is advocating giving up thinking about dynamical mechanisms to solve the cosmological constant problem. No one is advocating that. Okay? But as a pragmatist, it's difficult not to take seriously something that worked, okay? And this something that worked was not empty. It worked when everybody else said, everybody else was getting the wrong answer. We shouldn't forget how shocking the discovery of the accelerating universe was. And now, okay, so there's some qualitative idea, and it's not the empty set. And further explorations of this idea over the last couple of years have yielded more things that are not an empty set. So it could be a complete dead end of research, but so could everything else. So
optimism here would come from the fact that factor of 120 is might sort of make the landscape near the standard model very dilute, and basically, or at least there are
exactly
little pockets that are possible.
There are little pockets where forget even standard model. Okay, You can just ask, where can you make structure, period? Let me give an example. Sorry, I'll just give one more example of the sort of thing that, for instance, why do we have three generations? One of the great questions, right? Well, we always know it's very easy to have tons of generations. But when you have tons of generations, you don't have asymptotic freedom. There's no infrared scales to set up, okay? We know it's harder to get fewer and fewer generations. So it could just be, as a global selector, you look around. Where are the places where you have any asymptotic freedom, any infrared scale set up? That already is a big, cuts out a lot of things. And now maybe it's three and not two and not five, because that's the magic place where you've got to hit the sweet spot to make enough vacua to make structure. Okay? I don't know that it's going to turn out that way. I don't know that it's not going to turn out that way. And if it turns out that way, I think it would be terrific.
First here, and then and
No. It's okay. No. Can I just be very, well, very clear about this point? Yeah.
I'm going to translate.
Okay. Nobody sensible is saying that. Nobody sensible is saying that, and that's one of the biggest straw men that's used to back.
Yeah. So can.
Nothing fancy. Can I say one thing about this? And then, so in the argument that I was making, it is not at all saying that you have a million vacua of one kind and 10 billion of another kind, therefore you're more likely to live in one with 10 billion rather than a million. I'm not saying that. Someday we might be able to assign relative probabilities from cosmology, from something else, that would allow us to decide that question. I'm not saying that. I'm saying something else. If you have fewer than 10 of the 120 vacua, by 10 of the 120, I mean the number you need in order to find a small enough cosmological constant, you just can't do it. Okay? So if you have 10 to the 40 vacua, then you could do it if you were 10 to the minus 60 lucky. But 10 to the minus 80 lucky. But if you have 10 to the 40 vacua, you can just say, sorry, cannot do it. Period. No probability, no relative weights, nothing. Just not enough to find a small enough vacua. Over here, you have 10 to the 200. Beautiful. Enough. And you might have a chance of making structure.
But, yeah. But Anthony, let.
So independent of how cosmology, independent of anything, the question is there a vacuum? Forget
about. Well, yeah, what do you mean by chance is that you don't have chance to actually make a theory?
That's right. So I understand what Nima is doing, and I understand it as very different from what other people in this business are doing. Let me tell you what I think you're doing, and because I think you're doing what when I thought about this a long time ago, the conclusion I came to about how one should do it, and I think we're coming to the same conclusion because we've both been influenced by biology in different ways. And I think that being influenced by biology.
I'm married to a biologist, so I'm very influenced
by
biology.
I know that. Yeah. No, I think there's two things that one learns from when the same kind of problem was confronted by biologists. One of them is pay attention to the fact that there's a difference between genotype and phenotype, which you're doing all the time. That is, pay attention to the fact that what we're interested in is talking about, is explaining the values of the low energy parameters we understand and have access to. Okay? And the other thing is that if you want to do something which is explanatory with an ensemble where there's a distribution of properties, whether it's genes or parameters of the standard model or parameters of a fundamental theory, you cannot do it by, and this I think addresses what Anthony is asking. You cannot do it by saying there's some random distribution and then argue probabilistically from a random distribution. So let me say what you have to be doing, and maybe everybody agrees, and I would be overjoyed if everybody agrees about this. Okay.
You'd have to be an idiot.
Good. Okay. Well, but let me say then what you have to be doing. It's great if everybody agrees about this. Then I think it's wonderful. And then I'll pose a question. Okay. What you have to be doing is finding a mechanism which generates an ensemble such that almost every universe in the ensemble which is generated, okay, has some property, okay, which is A, not obviously implied by what we already know, either from observation or theory, and B, testable, and therefore can be tested and shown false. Okay. And if you have a mechanism which generates such an ensemble, you can then test that property, and if that property is not seen to be true of our universe, that mechanism is ruled out. Okay. And I think that that's, as far as I've been able to figure out, that's the only way a theory based on an ensemble of properties or parameters or rules or vacua can actually become science and be testable. And what that also focuses us on is what is the mechanism, because one doesn't test just the general idea that there are a lot of vacua or that there's a landscape. What one, the only thing that one can test is particular hypotheses as to the mechanism that forms the ensemble, because the only way you can actually pull this off is if your ensemble is very, very non-random. Okay. So maybe everybody agrees and everybody agrees that's what we should be doing, in which case the question is, okay, and this is what I wanted, what I get from the kind of argument that Nima is making, if the experiments convince us that the parameters appear to be fine-tuned and what we understand about fundamental theory gives us no explanation a priori for that fine-tuning, then the scientific question is, okay, there must have been some mechanism that produced that fine-tuning. What was it? And our job is to hypothesize and test.
We continue to care about it, by the way, right? So this is, you know, I think one of the big things to me, if this whole picture, I didn't understand everything you said, but I'm, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, I.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Not
just.
God. That's worse than the landscape, sorry. Yes. I would personally return to thinking about mechanisms to solve the cosmological constant problem. Even though the landscape would still remain the best way of making it small, I would give up. I would go back full time to thinking about ways of solving the CC. I'll still go back to thinking about ways of solving the CC. These aren't exclusive. One of the things that bothers me about this sort of discussion is like, what should we be doing? We this, we that. We're all different people.
Let me briefly summarize at least the optimistic sort of scenario. The optimistic scenario again is what both of you sort of are saying is that this kind of structure that we're now finding could still put us in a good spot if indeed the distribution, at least of things that we are close to what we are seeing, is sufficiently selective so that at least we can come up with certain characteristic things that satisfy all these constraints. But the fear that we're having a little bit, at least, and strangely I have that fear a bit, that's a somewhat more pessimistic scenario, is that these numbers may be so big that that basically anything goes. The reason why at some point, some level, we're pretty confident in the end that the standard model fits into string theory, and that confidence in some sense comes from the flexibility of string theory. So when you say, well, come up with a way of generating a distribution that can be falsified, the approach that we're actually taking in string theory is indeed we're taking our theory seriously, and we look at it, and we take what it gives. But I want to ask another question. Another question is the following. Okay, well, suppose that indeed we find all these vacua, and we have a certain, okay, one question that maybe I want to postpone a little bit but is, okay, how are we going to go about identifying the standard model of vacua, but it's a lot more technical. But suppose that we need, there's the standard model and there's this other stuff. Now, should I care about all the other stuff, or should I just say, well, we've achieved something, here's the standard model, and so is it. That's it. We're just like our solar system is somewhere in the corner of the galaxy, and there it is. here's our standard model. It's in the corner of some big gap.
That is how I think about it.
That's how I would think about it, too.
I think the biggest, I think Sean will prepare, I'll let you speak.
Yeah, I call that the Copenhagen interpretation.
One of the huge things about this whole thing is that it makes this quest of understanding our parameters and our universe and our, just as important as going to your local public library and finding about all the details of your like local town.
Am I missing then something very important about what this landscape is telling us?
I think you are missing something, and the difference is, and here I disagree, is that we don't observe these other universes, and we have no independent reason to believe in their existence except the theory, and the danger that we're in, which is the pessimistic fear, and I imagine it's what the direction your fear goes in, is that the theory may never be testable, and we may be left in this very uncomfortable situation where some people believe in a theory because it has mathematical elegance and blah, 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 and our colleagues are not convinced that because there's been no predictions made, and you can't make, you can make an argument on the basis of something you already know that X is environmental. Yes, we observe the whole rest of the universe, and therefore it's reasonable that there's an environmental reason why we're on the surface of a planet and not an intergalactic space where it's 3 degrees. But in the absence of direct evidence for this ensemble of universes, we can't use it as a cop-out.
But that's what we're saying.
It should physically be possible to get information. If it isn't, then if someone just proved a no-go theorem that even taking quantum mechanics and the fact that horizons disappear and we eventually tunnel out of the superspace and all of that, that there's no way of getting the information about the existence of all these other things out there, I would be very skeptical. But you know, I don't think we know enough to know either way. I would guess.
So are you arguing that
some way, maybe we might have to wait a long, long time, and the information is there somehow in the Hawking quanta whose wavelength is comparable to Hubble or something. I don't know. Okay,
but you're arguing these
not quantum mechanically forever, so there's I don't see an a priori reason why we can't get it.
Our universe came from somewhere, and sooner or later we'll see enough in primordial gravitational radiation.
There was a simple example. You know, we've seen it in the history of particle physics. Quarks were hidden behind the horizon for a long time. You didn't know how to see them. The people who believed in them made progress and won. The people who kept like saying, oh, they're not there, should I take it seriously, not take it seriously, they lost. You know, people who have like a sort of pragmatic sort of attitude and try to take it seriously and make predictions and push it forward have typically made progress. We eventually figured it out, and we had to accommodate our notion of what it means to see a particle. We had to figure out how we look at the, now, that took 10 years. I have no idea if it's going to take us 10 years or 100 years or how long it's going to take us to figure out how to see things behind the other universes. But it's not the first time this has happened in physics, where things that are in principle unobservable, or we don't know how to observe them yet. I agree with you that if the physical reason...
Any of the guys with the microphone? No? Yeah. So at some point, Nima was saying that you agreed with something. Did you agree?
60-40, I don't know. Well, I wanted to make two small comments in regards to your question from like 10 minutes ago. One comment is that normal science has always been that you find a theory that incorporates the previous correct theories, at least, right, or the parts of them that were correct, and there are limits of applicability, and you extend it by making one prediction. Okay, or maybe many predictions. If in string theory, you know, one of the people here, Miriam Svetich, produced the correct intersecting D6 brain model on a torus, computed everything she could, convinced us all that the Yukawa couplings are blah, 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 with such and such precision, and it agreed with data, and she made one more prediction. Okay, I think by the standards of anything that we've called science before, that's a tremendous victory for string theory. And that we should divorce some idea that the peculiarities that we happen to care about in string theory, the low energy stuff, is going to be uniquely determined in some beautiful way by the theory. That's irrelevant. What we'd like to have be true. What's true is if you can test it that way and it succeeds, it's a successful scientific theory. Now, the second thing I'd like to say, and it connects with the first, is pragmatically, whether you believe we'll eventually be able to classify all vacua, compute probability densities, and predict that the wave function of the universe is peaked on the conifold, or whatever the hell you want to predict, it seems to me that going through this exercise of thinking hard, how do you construct vacua, how do you stabilize moduli, how do you make a construction that's completely consistent, has been one of the most fruitful ways of generating ideas. And so in just the last year and a half of this stuff, very interesting ideas in cosmology related to cosmic strings, which are potentially observable, okay, a priori unrelated to the rest of the landscape stuff, but a potentially observable signature developed. Very interesting ideas about split supersymmetry, okay, a very testable scenario. A priori, it doesn't imply all the other vacua are there, but if it's true, it came out of this kind of thinking. So the metaphysical aspects of the situation that you're postulating all these other vacua don't have to enter in the scenarios that are generated that are testable. And the tests can be much more proximate.
So you, in the end, you're saying, well, they're part of the road towards a story. It's not that physically those are, because that's what's not clear about your story. So physically, are they there? Are you arguing?
We stopped yet at the moment, because we don't know how to physically see all these other universes, whether they're out there in space, whether they're part of some wave function in the universe, whatever, we don't know. We don't know how to do it. But, you know, physics does not often operate by understanding the whole theory first and then making predictions. You know, physics tends to evolve in a sort of seat of the pants way. And this is all stopgap until we figure out how to do that.
Based on this, I can draw an interesting conclusion. People also forget that, you know, when you talk about this one,
inflation, it's m dot squared over m one squared.
No, that's right. I think it's not. I don't know how the parameter came up.
No, but it's not very unreasonable that it's m to minus 5.
Yeah,
but,
okay. So let's take
one
step further. You can say that, okay, fine.
Alpha squared.
But I can imagine, you know, one part of 10 is 5, one part of 10 is 3, one part of 10 is 2, you know, order one fluctuations. So I can imagine all sorts of, you know, various values. I mean, one part of 10 is 18 or something like that. But then I, you know,
So, I mean, I don't understand the relevance of that.
Let's hope it doesn't happen in the next 20 minutes.
It is an interesting question whether that 10 to the minus 5 is somehow tuned, and it doesn't seem all that tuned to me. It's, I think, very likely. No. It's very plausibly an alpha square.
Robert wants to interject here.
In fact, I mean, all of these back reaction things from super idle nodes are, it's funny to complain about the landscape invoking universes beyond our horizon. This is much worse. It's invoking physics beyond our horizon in our own, in one patch to our chain.
Both.
Anyway, let's not discuss it. But anyway, let me say, for my part, I'm very far from being convinced. And
Okay, I'll go ahead. Yes.
Thank you.
Let me make a comment about that. I mean, quantum field theory has an infinite number of continuous parameters. Yeah, but that way of stating is extremely unsharp. I mean, by any reasonable definition, what Mike Douglas's wildest worst estimate of the number of vacua is much, much, much more constrained than the framework of quantum field theory that we ended up successfully testing against the standard model, or against the experiments that led to the standard model. I mean, in quantum field theory, you get to pick ab initio, a gauge group, and matter content. You get to continuously tune couplings, and an infinite class of consistent theories, mathematically consistent, were narrowed down to a very small class of theories that were tested and found to be correct. So at least as an abstract consideration, the fact that string theory has many, many solutions, though far fewer, as far as we know, than the number of possible field theoretic extensions of the standard model, that doesn't seem to me a very good ab initio objection. But furthermore, if it's true, it's true. It doesn't matter whether we want it to be true or not. We have to.
No. Okay. I think the approach would be as follows. I think people would probably agree with it. That given that the landscape is there, okay, what would be a way in which string theory leads to predictions, and also basically, first of all, it can suppose, and we find the standard model at least in accordance with observation. So we have a model within the landscape that agrees with observations. Then at that point, already string theory has indeed achieved something, as Shaman was saying. Basically, you start by incorporating the previous approaches. That's what string theory would be doing.
I mean, another thing.
Yeah, the thing that string theory would be adding to it would, for example, be a description of black holes, a quantum mechanical description of black holes. It may do say certain things about cosmology that we didn't know before. And then the optimistic scenario would be indeed that the particular realizations that we can make indeed have certain features that were not put in, say, from the fact that we want to. And that's still a very plausible scenario. And then indeed we haven't predicted that all these values of nature are that are observed in nature have to come out uniquely from the theory, but still we have done much more than any other framework, namely incorporating all these different corners of physics, and in addition, then within that model that has been tuned by choosing certain discrete parameters, make other predictions. So in that respect, string theory is still a predictable. Is it a theory that can lead to prediction?
One of the remarkable things about string theory when you start studying it in this way is that, first of all, the theory is mathematically consistent, so that now that we've understood mechanisms to stabilize moduli, when you ask reasonable questions about numbers of vacua, you actually get finite answers. So the step zero in this whole thing is to demonstrate that there are a finite number of physically sensible string theory vacua. And when you work on these vacua and try to make infinite classes of them, as Mike Douglas was mentioning in his talk, you find that there's something which cuts that off. And all indications so far are that there are a finite number of physically sensible string theory vacua. And it gives you hope that you can actually then go to step one, which is what everyone else is interested in. But
I'm going to turn into the bad guy here because look, this is a claim for a fundamental theory, and the stakes are really high, and the standards are the highest possible in science. Okay, so when string theory originally began to be investigated, one of the strong claims that was made is that it was a unique unification that would lead to unique predictions. Well, wait. Let me hear me out, and then you'll be really pissed off at me, and I'll shut up, okay? Because I have more to say, okay? And that is being given up. Maybe it was wrong, but it's worth a fair amount of thought to think about what's being given up. Okay, one. Two, the standards are high, and you can't just say things like string theory is known to be consistent. You have to be precise, and what's precisely known is that in flat 10-dimensional space-time, string perturbation theory is genus 2 consistent, and nothing further is known. Okay?
Come on.
Let's be precise here. And when you say that string theory has explained black holes, let's be precise again. We're talking about extremal and near-extremal black holes. There are no convincing results from string theory about ordinary black holes with negative specific heat, which are most astrophysical black holes. Now, in spite physics is really hard, and in spite of the fact that these important questions are open, I personally think it's still worthwhile that some people investigate it. But I think that we have to be honest and straightforward, given what the standards and the stakes are, and say when one is retreating, and because one has to be, at least the way I do science, and I hope it's the way everybody does science, is one has to have one's own private thing in a notebook of when do I give up, okay? And when you have to retreat from an important goal is when you have to go back to that and say, should we go on or should we give up individually, as Nima said, because it's an individual decision. And you can't finesse it. Giving up the idea that there is a unique theory that predicts phenomenology is a retreat from what the hopes were. And it's one that even somebody like me, who embraced the idea of the landscape years ago, feels bad about giving up.
Can I say something not as a string theorist? Okay, so two things. No. I know. But so if anybody should care about falsifiability and so on, it's me, and it's part of the reason for doing what I do. Nonetheless. Obviously, the theory is in principle testable. We should always distinguish between practically testable versus principle testable. In principle, we could build a Planck scale accelerator and discover Reggie trajectories. That's a obvious point. Okay. So B, string theory still is a unification of all the forces. We should just, it's remarkable. You take Yang-Mills theory, you take gravity, you put them together, everything comes out of one structure. In fact, it's stupendously amazing to someone who's studied the Standard Model for a long time and appreciates how bloody ugly it is, okay, that these things come out of one structure. The fact that there are moduli spaces and enormous numbers of vacua may even end up being a good thing. It does not change the fact that it continues to be a unification of all the forces. Yang-Mills and gravity are put together in a completely unique and amazing way. The fact that the gauge groups can change, the matter content can change, is totally irrelevant to me. And I say that as a model builder. I mean, not as someone who spends my life doing this. Okay? So the question is whether our question and our quest of explaining these numbers is the be-all and end-all. In the history of physics, explaining parameters does not have a good track record. Okay, explaining dynamics has always had a good track record. When we didn't understand dynamical questions, trying to crack dynamical problems has had a good track record, has led to progress. Obsessing over parameters has not had such a good track record. Kepler obsessed, the ancients obsessed, as everyone knows, about predicting the orbits of the planets. It just was not a good question. And the sooner you know it's not a good question, the better. You start focusing on the right question. We are in the uncomfortable position right now with the landscape, if it's all right. In my view, it says that particle physics, just not fundamental. Just not fundamental, okay? We should just swallow it and it's fine, okay? But in the same way, obsessing over predicting the parameters and all that stuff, not fundamental in the sense that understanding those parameters is no longer the window to the ultimate theory of everything that we had hoped it was. Okay? That's fine. Something else is, and we don't know what the something else is yet. There is a complete divorce, disconnect between fundamental short-distance physics and long-distance effective field theory. Okay? Something that, if it's true. The situation is like Kepler, okay? You know, a circle, 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 circles. The second you see it's an ellipse, wham! You know, that hope is gone, and the whole program of the whole program of predicting orbits is gone. Now, there was like 30, 40 years between that and figuring out what the right questions to ask are. We don't know what the new right questions that will lead us to the heart of the fundamental theory are. Mm-hmm. Probably they have something to do with cosmology. Probably they have to do with resolving Big Bang singularities. Probably they have something to do with that, the emergence of time, all of those things. Okay? It just does not seem like explaining the particular values of particle physics are all that close anymore to the real fundamental underlying questions of quantum gravity. No one ever promised us, I mean, no one ever promised us it would be the case. And I think,
I think this is sort of what you're describing completely agrees with, I think, with most people in our generation, sort of how we view string theory. I think the early claims about string theory, again, people did like David Gross, who had a remarkable success, again, won this big prize this year, for making a theory that has remarkably few parameters and explains a vast range of trajectories, resonances. You get this whole strong interaction physics out of a very simple, amazingly simple Lagrangian. 12 years later, there's a theory that sort of seems to be the correct theory for communication, and we're still in the same, we're still believing that. And at that point, it's natural to express the hope that what QCD did for the strong interactions, that what string theory could do that for the other parameters. Natural to express the hope.
Yeah.
But on the other, and I also agree with you that we should not easily give up on that hope. But what you're saying is exactly the right thing. At least it's not being productive to say, well, let's give someone string theory, lock him up in a room, and we'll come out with a standard model. That's not the way it works.
The difference between the fundamental theory and the vacuum is
John
the
wants
point,
to
right?
Okay.
Let me just say that everyone who works on string theory at some point kind of gets hooked by it. It's not about the consistency and unity. The awareness that there are QPs there that are not yet fully understood and that it's probably exploitable. And if the discovery made and it doesn't fit your prior prejudices of what you expected, it's probably a good strategy not to get dejected about it.
Very good.
If
I want to briefly go here.
Sure.
Then maybe if you had a reaction.
I just want to make a clarification then, Rafael. I mean, the speech that Nima made, I mean, of course the idea of unification through oscillations of extended objects is beautiful and compelling. Of course, the idea of duality is beautiful and compelling. That's why I also sometimes work on this theory. And when I work on it because I think it's worth my time to divert from quantum gravity to work on it because of the promise for unification. Okay. But I think that we also have to be clear about where hopes and expectations have not turned out, because it could be that this is what the theory is telling us, but it could also be that we're missing something. It could be that we're off in a wrong direction and that we should not all go chase this one direction down, because it could be that there's something that we missed in the first fundamental.
A lot of people here have said that, for example, with respect to the cosmological concept, and we'll get to that in a second, that there's still a hint out there that maybe effective field theory or maybe dynamical mechanisms, etc., there are other roads that should be explored. This is not the only road that should be explored, but it's certainly a productive thing to do at this moment.
I say, as the model builder, what attracts me about string theory was never its promise for unification, because I never believed it. What attracts me about it is that it's a theory of space-time, and that we've seen for the first time in things like ABS-CFT, you know, how gravity emerges out of strongly coupled field theory, these incredible things. That's what's exciting. The unification was never something I thought about.
Right. Same here. Okay.
When the question for the string theory might already be making a prediction which is falsifiable, and then you can be falsified within the next few years. And that's the prediction apparently that the cosmological concept
Yeah.
by the second w equals minus 0.95. That's it. It's over.
So
absolutely.
That, you say that?
If yes. If w is minus 0.95 and is 3 sigma away from minus 1, well, I don't trust cosmologists with their sigmas, but if I was convinced that w is minus 0.95, that's good bioelectric to me.
Really? Why? I mean, that's even more fine-tuned than the CC. If it's a quintessence field with Hubble scale mass asymptoting to zero,
I would say,
my God, every theory is out the window.
No, I would say every theory. No, I would then go. Yeah, I mean, there would be no.
See,
the point is, the second you have a quintessence field, this is really the point. The second you have a quintessence field around as well, then you don't need the discrete to solve the cosmological problem.
I agree with that.
You can have one scale with a very, very flat potential for the different values in different parts of the universe. Sorry? No, that's what I'm saying. So I'm saying, if we have evidence that W is not minus 1, okay, then we have some very, very light scalar wandering around. Then there's no need for the whole discretum of the landscape. Okay, you could just throw out the whole discretum and just live with the
structure.
Huh?
No,
just
draw a very, very small slope.
Yeah, very, very small slope over a huge range. That's right. That's right.
And, of course, the scale is slowly rolling.
It's one of the things that, yeah.
Eventually get
yeah, so, right, no, but, so this is what I'm saying. Having such an incredibly flat field, if you could find fields with such incredibly flat potentials in string theory, which there's absolutely no evidence for, then you wouldn't need 10 of the 120 different vacuums. You could just do with that one. So. Great. Well, then. The coincidence problem is explained by Weinberg's argument. This is something that people don't appreciate. Okay, Weinberg's argument predicts the triple coincidence. Predicts the coincidence. So there's two coincidence problems. One of them that we happen to be living in the era where all the things are comparable. There's a second epoch-independent problem that if you would just extrapolate the lines of energy for radiation, matter, and cosmological constant, all three of them meet very roughly at one place, a little bit like gauge coupling communication. That's an epoch-independent problem. At any epoch, in principle, you could measure those things and extrapolate and notice that. Okay, that is a prediction of Weinberg's. That is a prediction of this picture, because you have to wait until matter dominates. You have to wait until matter dominates over radiation for structure to start forming. That's the two lines crossing, and the cosmological constant is predicted to be right at the edge, which does that. So the triple coincidence is a prediction of Weinberg's argument. The fact, and we can only live after it, is another. Now, it's an interesting fact that we happen to be living pretty close to the area of that triple coincidence. That's related to the fact that the age of stars is comparable to the age of the universe. And the age of stars comparable to the age of the universe is parametrically the same thing, it turns out, as recombination happening at the same time as matter-radiation inequality. And that can be argued to also be important for stellar formation. I can tell you more about it in detail. But the triple coincidence itself, that epoch-independent statement, is a prediction of Weinberg's argument. It's one of the things I like very much. That argument. By the way, it also predicts this famous relationship between the cosmological constant, the Planck scale, and the weak scale. This famous geometric relationship between them, that lambda to the 1/4 v squared over m Planck, is another prediction of Weinberg's argument, and a huge class of theories with the dark matter, like the MSSF, the dark matter comes, it's related to the weak scale. So all of these things, you know, that's one of the things that many of them, I always used to think of as a hint of a deep connection between the hierarchy problem, the cosmological constant problem, and the scales all related to each other. It's a prediction of Weinberg's argument.
But you agree that to trust Weinberg's argument here, you have to live in a world like the one you believe in, where the dimensionless constants are allowed to vary very much. Because then you have to worry about delta rho over rho. And
sure. No, I wasn't talking about the... Of course, there's a detailed number. But putting the detailed number aside, there's just a sort of broad parametric relationship between the scales. This geometric parametric relationship between the scales actually is a prediction of Weinberg's argument. You can imagine observers with different values of the scale in different parts of the landscape, each one of them thinking, there's some magical relationship between these scales, but they're all wrong. It's just a very gross characterization of where structure came from.
Maybe one second. A lot of these landscape ideas are actually completely independent of string theory and have been ignored for too long because, as schema maps pointing out, what the strings are doing just leads to a new concept of naturalness. And you know, we might have been deluding ourselves by probability sequencing because that was a natural thing. But just, you know, this different perspective links independently to the gives new hints for what to look for, prediction. So it's not necessarily, I guess these ideas are not necessarily connected to string theory. Maybe these are some two separate.
But I think string theory adds this, the thing which I was mentioning, which I think is so exciting. If you have a microscopic theory that tells you what all the factors are, then it's possible to just use close requirements to tell you what particles exist. Whereas if you're just inventing the idea there's a lot of vacuum, you wouldn't know. You couldn't do anything more than a local exploration.
That's right. So in that sense, yeah.
Rather than sort of changing in terms of naturalness. So basically what's being done is, whereas naturalness sort of was putting constraints on what could be imagined, in this case we're just enlarging our parameter space. But are there, in the end, one is not advocating using statistical arguments as a way of, as replacing naturalness.
Not purely statistical.
In many cases, the statistical arguments have reproduced naturalness. For instance, the only way we know, at least that I know, of making numbers naturally small is the exponentials that come out of gauge dynamics or the logs in RGLang.
Right.
And if you look at the, you know, the attractor points on moduli space that come out of string theory,
Which means that the old notion of naturalness was actually a pretty good one.
By the way, and in these friendly, in the sort of friendly landscapes, it's a parametric prediction that the picture is that you have some scales that come from the marginal couplings determined by dimensional transmutation that are just laid down, and the relevant parameters that are tuned always by the gross environmental arguments always get nailed to powers of those scales that are determined by dimensional transmutation. So the ultimate seed for large hierarchies, one way or the other, is still dimensional.
Right.
Oh wait, but one place you would use statistics is to rule things out.
Yeah, right.
And
of course, I understand.
That's right.
Okay.
Looking back to this issue about consistency of analogies, since the robot can, I have a story. Part of the 19th century, the standard warrior part of Axman's molecules on the long calendar in the talks Tate. He prompted this theory of helium, the strings to be tied, dots in the strings. What is it? And there are even ways which Tate was dots. The thermal experiment showed that the explanation of the molecules is chemical bond. Which is really around the crust. Bonds and other chemicals, calories, stick. Either way, the steel disappeared because it was come back to the month. So it doesn't prove anything. One has to be cautious about just how the theory is consistent with observation, oscillated terms.
Everybody.
Okay. So maybe as a last question, you mentioned that at some point you would all tunnel to enter the Zeta vacuum. Can you, on the basis of these arguments, predict when that will happen? Not in the next few seconds. Okay. So
hopefully after dinner.
After dinner, let's do that. I think we have reached some consensus even. I think that was better than we expected. So let's thank the people in the
seems like you have a very lively debate on spring theory.